This episode is made possible by MailChimp. Ever heard of a clustomer? It's the result of marketers grouping customers with different behaviors into one big mess. But with MailChimp, you can use real-time behavior data to personalize emails for every customer based on their browsing and buying behavior, turning your customers into customers. Intuit MailChimp, the number one email marketing and automations brand. Visit MailChimp.com/personalize for more information. Based on competitor brands, publicly available data on worldwide numbers of customers in 2021-2022. Availability of features and functionality vary by plan, which are subject to change. Hello, everyone, and thanks for hanging out with us for the Behind the Numbers Weekly Listen, an eMarketer podcast made possible by Intuit MailChimp. This is the Friday show that got a haircut just for this podcast.
Who did?
It was actually a complete coincidence. Yeah, I know. Thanks for noticing.
It was you?
Yes. We had a meeting earlier as well. Didn't say anything then either.
Because I didn't notice it.
Fantastic. Feel appreciated. I'm your often ignored host, Marcus Johnson, in today's show. What social networks keep getting wrong?
Social media companies hold the power to make the internet better, essentially, is what they were saying. But I also feel like the expectations we have almost set these companies up for failure in many ways.
Can Amazon make its app fun?
It is hard to shake a brand reputation, which is they are not a fun place to go discover. They're a place to go transact and move on with your life. So there's that.
Do enough people care about voice?
But if more of them are asking questions like, how far away is the nearest drugstore? Or, you know, can I use this to do that? Potentially there's some traction for a new wave of advertising on voice.
Is the best way to return items Uber? How may AI change entrepreneurship? And which music format has made the most money in the last 50 years. Joining me for this episode, we have three people. Let's meet them. We start with our Vice President of Content based in New York. We call her Susie David Canyon.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Hello, hello. We're also joined by our Vice President of Everything Briefings based in New Jersey. It's Stephanie Taglianetti.
Cheers, mate. I actually got a compliment on my hair today.
Oh, good.
Unlike some of us other folks in the room.
I'm happy for you.
Thank you.
Really happy for you.
Thank you.
Wait, were you talking about my hair?
No, mine. Oh, you got one too?
No,
just Marcus didn't?
All right, perfect.
No, but I'm ready for one.
Max, if you say you got a haircut, I'm going to be bloody furious. We're also joined by Max Willins. He is one of our senior analysts on our digital advertising and media desk based in Philadelphia. Thanks for being here, fella. Unless you got a haircut, in which case you're about as welcome as the other two folks.
Does it look like I got a haircut?
You look
Does
fantastic.
This look cut to you? This is.
It looks no. like it was at one point cut.
If it had, I would have noticed. Unlike Stephanie.
Send me your Philly barber recommendations, everybody.
Don't go to Marcus's hairdresser because no one will notice.
Okay. Thank you.
But maybe that's the beauty.
No, it's not. It would have been nice to be appreciated. Now that my self-esteem is down the drain, what should we talk about? Social networks. What do they keep getting wrong? That's our story of the week. You guys are the worst. We then move to the game of the week because Susie made me. She said, I don't want to be on if it's a debate. So that's why we have the game, because Susie insisted.
Thank you.
We're talking about a bunch of topics, and our panel will try to give us the best takeaways they can to win the championship belt. We finally move to dinner party data. We'll talk about some random trivia.
Cool.
We start, of course, with a story of the week. What do social networks keep getting wrong? And how does a social network fail? Taylor Lorenz of The Atlantic thinks Elon Musk and Linda Yaccarino of X, formerly Twitter, are making the same mistake that has tanked other social networks. She writes, celebrities and high-profile figures have fled the platform, X that is, Twitter. Hate speech has risen. Mr. Musk's tweets have become erratic and hostile. He's threatened brands, briefly banned users for promoting links to use other social platforms, and is engaged in a battle with the Anti-Defamation League. Mr. Musk continues to dismantle and alienate the precise communities that gave the platform its power. Then going on to say, misunderstanding this dynamic and his hostility towards his own user base shows why X will ultimately fail. Folks, what did you make of this piece, this idea that this is a company, a social platform that is somewhat doomed if it continues in this direction?
So I think I would take that up a layer in terms of, I think they're all doomed in some way, right? And they've all stepped away from their original intention of connecting people, and they're just looking for ways to monetize, to be smarter. And so this one-to-one or one-to-many communication has sort of shifted gears. And so I think they're all going to have issues. Just the Twitter/X is pronounced because it's in the media. It has taken a turn for the worse because of the many, many different, very negative things that their new owner is trying to do. But at the end of the day, they're all struggling.
Yeah, I feel it, like, as loath as I am to give Elon Musk any credit, especially since his ideas for how to run X seem to change every 6 weeks, I do think that this tilt in the direction of forcing people to pay for it is, in the long run, if he chooses to stick with it and endure the near-term pain it's going to cause, could actually help a little bit. To what Susie was saying earlier, the notion that Twitter, you know, is a town square, or, you know, Facebook is the student union. Those days are completely over. And what's left is this kind of commons that is defined mostly by perverse incentives. And the only way to sort of get to the other side is to sort of tear down what exists already. And the only way to sort of make these into spaces where you want to interact a little more is you have to make sure that people have some skin in the game. And forcing people to pay for something feels like the easiest way to get there, short of forcing people to use their real names the way that LinkedIn does, for example. So I think that on some level, there's a lot of potential there, but it's going to be painful, especially because of the advertiser exodus that Twitter seems to be dealing with. There was some data that our sister company Insider got from Ebiquity earlier this week, which implied that 90% of the US's largest advertisers have stopped spending on Twitter. And that seems like a big problem, especially because they don't really have the kind of long tail advertiser base that a Meta has, for example.
See, I would like to respectfully disagree. I don't think that you can build it and they'll come. It's kind of like in retail, if you think about the marketing folks get the consumer into the channel, whatever that channel is. But if we don't have the right product as a retailer, people aren't going to buy from you, right? So you need to have the right product at the right price and the right channel for it to work. And you just can't force people into this made up community and, or for me, retail space to want to participate with you. Yes, if they pay for it, they will definitely feel more obliged to use it. But I pay for my gym membership and it's expensive and I really don't go enough. It's like I'm subsidizing them. So I also don't know if paying $14 a month is going to change the way people are interacting. It's just not a nice, and I don't mean user experience from all the ads and you don't get to see who you want to see. It feels very forced. It feels like there's so much bad information. It feels like it's memes after random posts and it's just not what it used to be.
Really quickly, just to clarify, Max, you also talking about the suggestion of the $1 a year for the ability to post, or are you talking about the Twitter Blue?
I'm talking about the pay to post.
The pay to post. Okay, yeah.
Oh,
so
recently,
no. Recently, I mean, there's a lot going on.
But
so
that
to keep
too,
up.
Right? Because if it's pay to post, it's like there'll be even more lurkers. There'll be even more passive people. Like if I have to pay to post, am I really going to bother? I don't know.
So $1, yeah, $1 for the year to be able to post is what Mr. Musk's suggesting. Pay to post, then you can still passively consume, you can still read things. The one thing with that is interesting, which I mentioned on the show the other day, is that Pew Research had found that about 10% of its users account for about 80% of its content. And so very few people post. And of those 10% of people, they post about 120 plus times a month versus the majority of people, the other 90% of folks who mainly read and are responsible for just 20% of the content, that 90%, they only post twice a month. And so I don't think a ton of people are going to care too much about paying that to post. So I don't know how much money it's really going to make for the company or how people are going to react to it. But that is the initiative that Max is talking about. Stephanie, what do you think of this?
Well, I think Susie was talking about like sort of the perfect social environment. And I think the two articles you shared were quite lofty about how social media companies hold the power to make the internet better, essentially, is what they were saying. But I don't know. I also feel like the expectations we have almost set these companies up for failure in many ways, because we're basically saying provide a nearly undetectable and organic advertising environment while
while not being too polarizing with the voices that appear on it. Be accurate, but don't be like too accurate that the loud voices get drowned out, because there's people who sign in because they think that's entertaining, but still make it safe, still make it like meet the needs and social habits that change very quickly and develop very quickly. And if you could just be present everywhere without making it feel like you're spying on me, that would be great.
It sounds easy. I don't know what you're saying. What you're getting at.
It's called being a media company, well, though, honestly. Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's the thing that I think is so hilarious about all of this, is that they're complaining. They're like, it's so difficult to have to rein in and control what's going on in this, you know, environment that, you know, is, oh, what's that environment for? Oh, to post ads. Yep. Yes, I see. Yes. And the ads want to be in a space that, like, they want it both ways. Yep. And I think that that's another thing that needs to be kind of grappled with here, too. But yeah, it's great to be talking about it, because it does feel like we're right at the very beginning of everybody having a kind of global reckoning with what to do about the sort of structural challenges that social media has. And it's going to be fascinating to see how people answer the questions. Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I would add to that also, the second article was talking about roles and responsibilities when you're in a community. And it feels like X is trying to have a more heavy-handed role, and people are upset about it, right? And so then you start to ask yourself, what do roles and responsibilities look like when you're in a free, not in terms of money, but free community, where you can say what you want to say and share the information you want, the pictures you want, where on the back end, they're saying, no, you actually can't. And there are too many bad things happening for you to do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're great points, folks. Something's got to change, because we think that today, users of X, Twitter in the US, there are 3 million less than there were last year. So they've lost 3 million users from last year to this year, Americans using X at least once a month. And that next year, X will lose a further 5 million, bringing the total to 52. And it doesn't look very promising into the future, 2025 and beyond. So they're going to do something different. I mean, Stephanie was talking about how hard, you know, a lot of this is, and Matt saying, well, that's a media company. Deb Roy, who's a professor of media arts and sciences at MIT, who wrote one of the articles in The Atlantic, which we were reading for this, may have the answer, apparently, saying today's social platforms are designed for spectacle and entertainment, but it's not too late to build a platform that improves society, saying that him and his colleagues thought deeply about how to make the internet better, more productive, and they've come to learn as new kinds of social networks that can be designed for constructive communication, for listening, dialogue, deliberation, and mediation, and they can actually work. So him and his colleagues think they've got a solution to this. We'll cover that story in next week's story of the week, but that's all we got time for today. We move, of course, to the game of the week. Today's game, what's the bloody point? Roy, read out four stories and have contestants Susie, Stephanie, and Max tell us what they think is the main takeaway of the story. Okay answers get 1 point, good answers get two, and answers that give you the same feeling, I think I've nailed it this week. I think I've got one point. Answers that give you the same feeling as when they close the door to the plane and the rest of the row is empty seats.
That is a good one. Yes.
I win the game.
Nailed it.
Finally.
Okay. Finally. Didn't need that. Let's edit that out. Thank you. Please, Victoria. Answers that leave you with that feeling, they get you 3 points. Each person gets 20 seconds to answer before they hear this. If you run long,
you
shame on you.
You said 20?
20 seconds. Did I say minutes?
No, I thought you said 30 seconds.
It's been 30 before.
No, it's been 20 the entire time.
No, it hasn't.
Yeah, it has. I literally
read
that
line.
And just
like your metaphors are always real good for what people like. Like, that's also a fact.
I think I'm going to win.
Who invited Stephanie?
I'm just saying.
It was
Victoria. I said Stephanie is not to be on anymore. What happened? I invited her. That's what happened. 20 seconds to answer before you hear that. It's always been 20. I say 20 because you guys always run long. And if you run long, shame on you. And minus 2 points. Two offenses will get you banished from the game. Most points wins, gets the last word. Let's play. We start with, who's on the scorecard? Susie. For round one, can Amazon make its app fun? Asks our senior retail analyst, Zach Stambor. He writes that the online shopping giant is currently testing a feature on its mobile app called Consult a Friend, that aims to make shopping on its platform more collaborative and engaging. But Susie, can Amazon make its app fun? What's the point?
No, there's no point. I think Amazon can try.
Okay. Moving on.
But I mean, I'm trying to stick to the 20 seconds. I think Amazon can try.
We'll see.
But it is hard to shake a brand reputation, which is they are not a fun place to go discover. They're a place to go transact and move on with your life. So there's that. I think the idea of consult a friend could in theory work. However, all the stars have to align in a really massive way. Everybody has to have the app. Everybody has to be on at the same time, ready to stop whatever they're doing to engage with their friend. Like, it just doesn't seem to work. And then the idea around it being a good way to help with group gifts could have some legs. Like, of all the things that it talked about, that would probably be the easiest one. But at the same time, there are lots of great ways to already do that, like WhatsApp. So why create a new platform? It's back to the network effect. If people aren't on it, it's not going to work.
Stephanie.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if the feature that's being talked about is fun, but I can see why it might be useful. Thing that always sways me most on a purchase is like reviews and photos. I like to see, for example, a dress on a woman with a similar body to me before I buy it. But like, do we really need a social engagement aspect on Amazon? Do people actually want to spend more time there, or do they want to use it like a utility tool? I personally don't want to spend more time on Amazon than I already am.
Max.
I can share any product available inside of Amazon's app with anybody in iMessage or popular social apps in two finger taps. I don't see how they can make this faster. I don't think anybody is going to want to spend more time in the app. Like both Stephanie and Susie said, this is not going to work.
Very nice, folks. Let's move to our second round. We start with Stephanie. We're talking about whether enough people care about voice. According to our forecasting team, 145 million Americans will use a voice assistant this year, 90% of those folks on a smartphone. But that's less than half of internet users. And in 4 years' time, it will still be less than half of internet users. So, Stephanie, do enough people care about voice? What's the point?
Yeah, I think the forecast is also talking about how people aren't really using smart speakers for that, which I was unsurprised to hear. It's such a massive... It's such a massive behavior change to use a device for something like ordering groceries in healthcare. But yeah, do enough people use it? 145 million. I was trying to think of a good proxy, and I was surprised to know that there are more voice assistant users than wearable users, for example. 89 million of those would have wrongly guessed if you asked me that in the multiple choice question. But yeah.
Max.
So I think the biggest question around this is a question that comes up in Chris's story, which is about what the composition is of the people that we describe as inquirers, which are people that ask their assistants questions. Like, are 80% of those people asking questions like the ones we ask Yelp or Google, or are they asking, you know, if what the capital of Djibouti is? Because if it's the latter, then we're right to kind of ignore this as a channel. But if more of them are asking questions like, how far away is the nearest drugstore? Or, you know, can I use this to do that? Potentially there's some traction for a new wave of advertising on voice.
Susie.
So I think I would even take that one step further and delineate that there are smart speakers, there's the phone, there's the car, there are a lot of different devices that we're considering voice, and they all kind of have a different use case, right? So I use my Google Home every day. I am so sad when I'm traveling and she's not with me. I ask her what time it is every 5 seconds when I think I'm running late. The weather, I use her as a phone when my phone battery has died and I need to call my parents. Like she is an integral part of my life. Sometimes I ask her to tell me jokes. She plays music, podcasts. So like, I think that it is an amazing device, the speaker. I don't have a car, so I can't speak to cars, but I think it's, if you are thinking about it as an advertising tool, probably not. It's a speaker, right? It's already getting advertising from podcasts. If you're thinking about it as a shopping mechanism, also probably not. What are you going to buy? You know, then you need, again, that whole connected, like it has to be the Amazon Alexa that's connected to your Amazon Prime account that you can just do a quick shopping thing. So not, it, like Max is saying, I think it just depends on what you're trying to accomplish.
It's interesting. Of all the things you speak to this device about, you've not once thought to ask them how to keep a tomato garden alive.
I did not want to show you my tomato garden. That's why I'm recording from the office. There are new flowers blooming.
I mean,
it is coming on strong.
Is it?
Yes.
I've heard Susie ask to turn the lights on for her Christmas tree many a time, actually.
Yeah.
It didn't work.
Yes, it does.
Did it work?
Like, not even
remotely.
Yes, of
course it works. What are you talking about? I forgot. I use Google to turn my lights on.
Try to turn the lights on.
I love her. I could not live without her, honestly.
Love?
Love.
Okay. I think this is referred to as the Eliza complex.
I think it's referred to as her starring Joaquin Phoenix.
Yeah, or that.
I don't know. Or I'm that. Canadian. I don't know what you're talking about.
Susie, we might have an intervention after this recording.
I don't know what so you're you talking about. I have no idea.
Just stick around after the show. We'd appreciate it.
You're going to love my dinner party data. It's like kind of fell right in.
Not looking forward to it. So two quick things from me I thought were great points in this piece from Chris Keating, who is our research director. One is, in 4 years' time, Gen Z will pass millennials as the generation with the highest uptake of voice assistants at 64%. And then the second thing was, which surprised me, you're more likely to hear OK Google than hear Hey Siri or Alexa. I apologize if I've turned on everyone's voice assistants, but it makes a good point. Google Assistant maintains its lead in terms of the most used voice assistant with over 85 million US users this year. The others aren't that far behind, about 5-6 million. But yeah, interesting to see that Google is out in front in terms of its assistant. All right, the halfway mark. Susie, God knows how, is out in front with 5. Stephanie and Max tied are on 4 points. All to play for. We move to round 3. We start with Max. The best way to return items, is it Uber? Uber has recently introduced a package return service, writes Elisa Luckpat of the Wall Street Journal. For $5 or less, Uber drivers will now ferry packages to the post office or a UPS or FedEx store in dozens of metro areas, including Chicago, LA, and parts of New York. Each parcel must be sealed and valued at less than $100. But Max, the best way to return items, Uber? Question mark. What's the point?
I just think that this is a strange sideshow for a company that has struggled with profitability basically for its entire existence. The article says that the price for these returns is going to be $5. And I just don't see how that juice is worth the squeeze for the drivers. I mean, you know, you look at how expensive a ride is now. And at the moment, Uber is barely profitable. Its core business is barely profitable. And that's with rides that, you know, are twice or even three times that price. So this just seems like a very strange, quixotic attempt to add incremental revenue, even though it's not going to be profitable revenue. So I think this is very strange.
Susie.
So I think it's interesting because originally the question, the way you asked, is Uber the best way to return items? And the answer, like Max is saying, is no. There are lots and lots of different reverse logistic companies that are sort of integrated into people's lives that makes more sense, like Walmart Plus. You know, if you have a membership, you can come and they'll pick up your stuff on your way. If you live in a doorman building, the postal service is already coming to your door. You can go to the Whole Foods and drop off Amazon stuff. So like there are a lot of ways to minimize the dollar value that retailers have when it comes to return. I think the question is, but Max clearly feels like this is not the right thing, is Uber doing this as another way to become more sticky and more part of everybody's everyday life, like some of these other DoorDashes of the world, right? And in that case, could it potentially work because they're trying to help you be more efficient in your day-to-day life?
Mm. Yeah, the Walmart point's interesting, rolling out at-home return pickups for subscribers of, yeah, Walmart Plus, and the DoorDash example, doing package return pickups back in since January. Stephanie?
Yeah, no, it's not the best. Okay. It's going to cost you $5 a pop, whether you're, you're returning one thing or five things. I was talking with Zach Stamber, who covers retail on my team, about this earlier today, and he was saying, like, in big cities where people don't have cars or just, like, a family car, it could catch on. But the average person isn't thinking about the cost it takes them to get to a facility where you're already conducting a return. And then there's a ton of free options in stores like Kohl's and Happy Returns and Petco, where there's just this virtuous circle of free return process while you're already in a store and then giving that store the foot traffic back. So No, it's not the best way.
Does anyone remember Uber Rush? Because they've tried this back in 2015. They tried to be a package courier back in 2015, where they offered a service called Rush. Drivers collected return items in select cities and made same-day deliveries for retailers. Uber closed Rush 3 years later in 2018 because of stiff competition, which I don't remember. It sounds vaguely familiar, but then after reading this,
a little familiar.
The question for me is, well, okay, why now?
So I don't remember it at all, but I think it's probably the economies of scale are better today and everybody's doing it.
Right.
And it probably is not because they're trying to make more money, but it's another way of being like, look, we're here to help you, whether it's food, getting to the airport, picking up stuff from a different store that you think you want, not a food, like a quick service restaurant or a regular restaurant. I think they're just trying to build out their assortment of products and services that they're offering.
Yeah. All right. Well, heading into double points round 4, Susie still out in front, 7 points. Max and Stephanie just behind, tied on 6. We start with Susie for round 4. How AI may change entrepreneurship. Bart Ziegler of the Wall Street Journal writes that coming up with an idea to create a marketing plan, AI adds a whole new element to starting a business. He walks through how an entrepreneur could use AI. So a couple of ways, going from kind of inception all the way through to here's the thing, I'm trying to market it at you. So first of all, asking an AI system to identify the problem in the first place that consumers might face with products or services, and then have it suggesting solutions. Associate Professor Ethan Mollick at UPenn's Wharton School was saying this could be something people were using AI for. After that, after you've identified the problem, entrepreneurs could see what has been reported about a business concept across the web, social media, and in consumer surveys to see what types of startups have failed or thrived. Then you can ask the AI to pretend to be a practitioner or a potential customer in said industry to ask it questions about what constraints it faces and whether the proposed idea would help. And then two final points. One is it could then act as a venture capitalist to offer constructive criticism before you got in front of the real thing. And then finally, you could have the AI create a credible marketing plan, identify a target audience, and create sample emails for potential buyers. So Susie, how AI may change entrepreneurship, what's the point?
So I think AI as it stands, like machine learning and AI, recognizing patterns is not new, right? So it's obviously not going to change entrepreneurship today. It's that generative AI component that may or may not help. And I feel like what the examples that the professor was talking about are much more about that, like learn, adapt, keep going, keep pushing. So that's the Gen AI part, not the AI part, which can potentially help because it's almost like you have free labor. But the problem is that it works on the foundation of the data has access to. And right now that's kind of missing.
Stephanie.
Yeah, well, right. It's nice to think that AI can maybe someday potentially change entrepreneurship as it gets smarter. For example, by not giving me information about McDonald's when I'm asking it about Walmart. From my experience and my team's experience, they will talk to you about how AI is very much, generative AI specifically, in the overly eager intern who still needs a lot of oversight phase of existence. So I think we need to get to the point where we can trust the information that it's spitting out before blowing up what it can potentially do.
Max.
I've spent this entire episode being pretty grouchy and pretty pessimistic. But
this episode? I'm kidding, of course.
I didn't even think you were being grouchy.
I didn't. I wouldn't want to see you when you're being grouchy.
That's true. That is definitely true. I actually sort of really like this. I mean, I think that what we've learned so far, and both Susie and Stephanie have alluded to this, and everyone that's played Gen AI at all knows this innately, which is that right now, this is a tool for sort of spinning up minimum viable products, for whipping up first drafts, for coming up with spaghetti to throw at a wall. And I think that as an idea for sort of helping people figure out the viability of ideas fresh out of the gate is actually really compelling and really interesting. You know, do I think that you should be able to sit down with ChatGPT for, you know, 45 minutes and then call a venture capitalist and begin raising money? No. But do I think that this can kind of help you get an idea, you know, out of your head and, you know, onto a piece of paper more quickly? Yes. And I think that's kind of cool.
Mm-hmm.
That is a more optimistic way to think about it.
Yeah.
Well, I like the focus group idea, right? Like, yeah. Focus groups are hard to do. So the idea that you can ask ChatGPT and get feedback, the part that I'm a little bit more sad about is that the data is only as good as the data that's already there.
Right.
And so once there is more data, then I think you might be able to take 45 minutes and get a really solid focus group going.
Mm-hmm.
Today, I think it's a little bit harder.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Great points, folks. Great points. That's the end of the game of the week. We check the scores. This is where we insert a drum roll.
This is where my heart starts beating super fast.
Susie, is this week's winner of the game of the week? 11 points
I don't
to
believe
Susie.
You.
10 and 10 each for Max and Stephanie. Susie's this week's winner.
No way. This never happens.
Okay, so Susie did tell me before the recording when she won, she was going to act surprised. So that's what's happening here.
Okay. Yeah,
I knew it.
Oh my God, I didn't realize I was going to win.
She was like, Congratulations. You get the championship belt and the last word.
I had a meeting this morning. No, I don't have a last word. I didn't think I was going to win.
Oh, this is seriously what everyone says. Yeah. Though.
Okay, then you know what? I'm going to tell you something.
Waste of everyone's time.
I tried a TikTok recipe that was on my Instagram feed. So it wasn't even on TikTok.
Okay.
I did not follow the recipe 100%.
Perfect.
It was bad.
What were you making?
Is it because of the former statement?
My PSA is follow the recipes on TikTok. They on purpose only have like 4 steps. So if you add a 5th step because you think it's going to help, it's not. Follow the recipe.
You added a what did you try and make?
I tried to make that boursin cheese in the oven with the lemon and the garlic.
And what did you
do? Basil. She doesn't squeeze the lemon. She just puts it in the Pyrex. And I squeezed the lemon because I thought I should squeeze the lemon. What else would it be there for? And it was so bad.
I love that it took just a short video for by the end of it. Susie's like, this fool doesn't know what they're talking about. I'm going to add just a little squeeze of this.
I mean, why cut and put a lemon into the dish if you're not going to squeeze it, I guess?
Because otherwise it will taste bad.
Because it will ruin
that. Well, now I know. Follow the video to the second. There's a reason why it's under 2 minutes.
Good advice. Congratulations to Susie. She's this week's winner. Well played, Stephanie.
Oh my God,
Max.
Thank you.
Very, very close. Stuart, please make sure she doesn't take the championship belt
home. Of course
home.
I am. That's what happens when you go to the office.
Please, Stuart, for the love of God, watch her. Okay, that's all we've got time for this segment. It's time now for Dinner Party Data. This is the part of the show where we tell you about the most interesting thing we've learned this week. We start with Susie because she's this week's winner, and she's been bragging since she got invited onto this episode about how amazing her dinner party day is going to be.
So
I have
excited.
Astronomical expectations, which I shouldn't.
I'm just glad that Susie is only bringing data to this dinner party and not a TikTok made recipe.
It was so bad. I'm so sad about it too.
Kitchen caught fire. All right. What we got?
I am so excited about this. So I have a friend who is a 4-year-old, and every time I see him, I'm like, do I get a hug? So he knows that I'm the auntie that he hugs. He gives me hugs all the time now when he sees me. It's like second nature. My friend sent me an Instagram article about hugs and the power of hugs. So did you know that there was a National Hug Day, January 21st? It started in 1986. And is celebrated all over the world, especially in the US and the UK.
By who?
Kevin.
Who have you ever come across who's like National Hug Day?
That boss that no one likes.
Starting today.
Well, no, starting in January.
Hear that, Stuart?
Yeah. But starting today, you're all going to know that January 21st is Hug Day and you should hug.
Go to the office that day.
Absolutely hug. I will.
And Susie will hug you.
I for sure will.
Okay.
Kevin Zaborni invented the day because he wanted to spread kindness and love, and the world is falling apart. So I thought that we should also all remember to hug your friends, hug your pets. Apparently, it doesn't matter who's hugging you, but what matters is that it needs to be 10 seconds. That's the optimal time.
Okay, no, that's
to lower your blood pressure,
no.
Boost your immune system. And there are so many studies on this, but I'm going to leave you with one thing. Which is, do you know where the word comes from?
Hug?
Yeah.
No.
It's from a Northern Germanic Scandinavian word that means to comfort. And it first appeared in the 1500s, the mid-1500s. And the theory might be that they were hugging as a way to show friendship because you need both arms to hug, which means you can't have a sword to stab someone.
Aha!
This comes back to stabbing. We had this with the shaking of the hands. That's why we shake hands.
That's why chopsticks exist. Sword
in your
I would also say, in addition to the 10-second duration, that's also consent. Consent.
Of course. That goes without
even with consent, 10 seconds is too
that
goes an uncomfortable amount of time.
Don't hug just any old person.
Everyone listening, you try and hug the next person that you were supposed to hug. Hug them for 10 seconds. See what happens. See
but
if they
I will
hang
tell
out with you.
You
again.
There was an article in the Oprah Daily online magazine, and we all know that there's an epidemic of loneliness. And did you know?
Especially among seniors, yeah.
that social disconnection is equal to smoking 15 cigarettes a day. So get consent and hug a friend. Apparently you can also self-hug. That also is legit.
Yeah.
And you can hug a pet. And it's not the best
ones. I do love
a good
hug. I was with you until 10 seconds, but I think you're right there. I definitely think the world could use some more hugs. All right, you were right. This was pretty good.
Pretty good.
Yeah,
Thank you. I'm beaming.
Finally, took about 4 years for you to bring something that we didn't have to cut out. But Max, you're up, mate.
So I was thinking a little bit about how earlier this month Birkenstock went public. Did not do well in its IPO, which surprised me. But one of the things that really leapt out at me is the fact that it took Birkenstock over 200 years to go public from when they founded. And I got to thinking, with a major assist from my colleague and manager, Paul Verna, about who else is on this list? Who else are the sort of late bloomers or late IPOers? Mm. And I found someone at Benzinga who had gone and done this homework for me. So Birkenstock now becomes the oldest company to IPO for the first time. It unseated, I guess I'll ask, anybody have any guesses what it unseated?
As the oldest company to IPO?
That's right.
I've learned my lesson about taking random guesses.
I know. I don't want to take a random
guess. No, I know. I love taking the random Canadian brand ones because it's obviously not true, but then I put a plug for a Canadian brand. Roots Canada.
Nice. That is incorrect. Hermès is the answer.
Oh, Hermès.
They were around for 162 years before they IPO'd in 1999.
Wow.
Just ahead, or I guess behind them, is Philip Morris International, Goldman Sachs, and Berkshire Hathaway. Kind of round that list out. Oh, and then Lindt. The chocolate makers.
Oh, Lindt.
Mm. Oh, Lindt.
Oh,
wait, no, just kidding.
Them.
You're right. It's not Lindt. It's Linda, which I should look up.
Linda chocolates?
L-I-N. It's a chemical company, actually. So
very nice.
One thing is great to eat. One thing is not.
One thing, don't eat it.
Should be avoided.
No, they're a chemical company, and they were in business for over 120 years before they IPO.
Wow. Very nice. Very nice indeed. Stephanie, you're up.
Okay, we got some spooky stats
here
from Halloween Victoria. Cue the spooky sound right here, right here. Okay, cool. I thought there were... She'll do it. I thought there were some interesting stats in this list that I found, like some classic ones, like around how much projected spending there will be in 2023, which is $12.2 billion, and how much will be spent on candy, $3.6 billion. But more interesting ones was that $13 million is expected to be spent on direct property damage caused by Halloween house fires.
Oh.
57% of Americans said that they would consider purchasing a haunted house to live in, but
how many?
57%.
No.
But only, here, maybe this makes a difference, only 18% would pay full market value for it.
Still no. Unbelievable. 57% said haunted house, why not?
I would purchase
it. Let's give that a try. Have they not seen Paranormal Activity? Absolutely not. That's insane. America.
No one else would do that? No one else would do that here? A haunted house. A known haunted house. I would do it.
You would? Max?
At a discounted rate.
Would you, Max?
Depends on the mortgage.
Because I have dreams of opening a Scarebnb, and so I think that this would just make my reality happen.
I mean, we're all talking about loneliness. Like, if you've gotten ghosts and, you know...
You got a built-in
Wait, so hang on a second.
Or
they're
several.
They're never going to leave.
No.
And neither are you.
So me and Susie say no. So Max and Steffi say, Victoria, can you break the tie for us? What do you think? Because if you say yes, then it will be 57%.
For haunted houses?
Yeah.
I'm a little bit biased because a ghost lives in my house.
Oh, yeah.
So then it's a yes.
So it is a yes.
Right there.
But here's
right.
the thing. Are we talking poltergeist or are we talking like...
Let's get specific.
Cast a friendly
just
ghost.
There was no scale of how haunted, you know, from anywhere from a little bit haunted to very haunted, I would say.
Oh, yeah, I'd live in something a little bit haunted. That's totally fine.
But would you get a big discount on the house, though? No, it's probably, they think it's part of the charm, and so then I'm even more no thank you.
Yeah, I'm with you.
I mean, if there's enough, there's clearly enough buyers that would pay full price for it, so you probably don't have too strong of a leg to stand on.
Maniacs.
There.
I have no leg to stand on. I don't want it. You can
you know who else doesn't have legs? The ghosts who live
well
in your
played.
New home.
Well played. Casper, maybe. That's the list. All right, folks, I've got one for you real quick. So in the last 50 years, which music format has made the most money when adjusted for inflation? So a terrific article in Visual Capitalist by Niccolo Conte and Bruno Venditti explored the answer. And they found that according to data from the Recording Industry Association of America, any guesses which music format?
When you say format, you mean like vinyl,
MP3,
cassette?
Vinyl, exactly, yep.
Gosh.
Since what year?
Since
the last
year?
50 years, so 73.
I think CDs.
CDs? Yeah, I think Susie is right.
I'll say vinyl just for posterity.
Okay, it is CD. You probably wanted to say CDs as well. I'm sure Stephanie as well, but it is CDs. Yeah, they've made nearly $370 billion for the music business. Vinyl and cassettes in an almost joint second have each made just one third of that number. Around $130 billion. Paid streaming is in a distant fourth with half of that. So $60 billion for paid streaming in fourth, CDs, $370 billion.
Wowza.
Yeah, CDs just dominating. Some really fascinating stats from here. So a couple for you. US recorded music revenues rose for the seventh year in a row, hitting $16 billion. Number two, digital music revenues comprise 90% of the US music industry's revenue. Today, streaming services, Spotify, Amazon Music, Apple Music, things like that, make up 84% of total industry revenues. The number of paid subscriptions to on-demand music services flew past 90 million. That's double what it was in 2018. And then two more for you. Vinyl is balling out. That's the first time I've said that. I don't think it worked. Outsold CDs in terms of units for the first time since 87. Outselling CDs. Vinyl sales also grew in 2022 thanks to millennials leading the charge. Why? The article pointing to superior audio quality of vinyl, it being a collector's item, and the appeal of having a beautiful record player in your living room. Mm-hmm. Final one for you. In 2007, ringtones made $1 billion, which at the time accounted for 10% of that year's music revenues. Shout out to ringtones. They've made $7 billion overall in the last 50 years. Wow. And if anyone else isn't thinking about that damn crazy frog right now, I don't know where your head's at. That's all we've got time for this episode. Thank you so much to my guests for a fantastic one. Thank you to Max.
Always a pleasure, Marcus.
Thank you to Stephanie.
Cheers, mate.
Didn't need that. And thank you to Susie, this week's winner of the game of the week.
Oh my gosh, thanks so much for having me and for letting me win, everybody. I appreciate it.
You earned that. He didn't let you.
Kind of. Thank you so much to Victoria, who edits the show and adds spooky music. Thank you to James, who copy edits it, and Stuart, who runs the team. Sophie, also thank you to her for running our social media. Thanks to everyone for listening in. For more episodes, you can hit the subscribe, follow button, and also the bell icon to turn on notifications for new content when we have it. We'll see you guys on Monday, hopefully, for the Behind the Numbers Daily. As an e-marketer podcast made possible by Intuit MailChimp. Happy weekends.
Did you see the meme about about the ghosts and the sheet ghosts? You know, like everybody talks about the sheet ghosts.
What do they talk about? What do you mean?
That like whenever you see a ghost dressed up for Halloween, it's usually someone in a sheet with the big open eyes.
Yeah.
And then the meme was something like, you know, memes don't translate well in words. They're better in images. But it was like the image of that ghost. It said, this is everybody who's tried to fold a fitted sheet. This is how they end up.
That's pretty good.
I was like, yes.
This is painfully true.